Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Supernatural George. I'm Mittens, and today we're going to be talking about Season 7, Episode 13, The Slice Girls, written by Brad Buckner and Eugenie Ross Lemming, and directed by Jerry Wanick. Our very first of three episodes that he will direct, but of course, he's our fearless art department leader for pretty much the entire series. So we love Jerry and everything he does. And I always felt his directing made this episode far less cringy than it could have been, because this could have been awful. I mean, it's not great, but oh my God, it could have been so much worse. Dean is still obsessed with Dick. Roman, that is. But Sam drags them halfway across the country to look into a strange case. Dean really doesn't want to be there, and we start seeing him spiral more seriously into alcoholism and nihilism around this point. But there's the whole contentious issue around Dean's rape by deception monster baby that never even got the chance to make a single choice about anything before Sam executed her in some sort of twisted tit-for-tat over the murder chick who kissed him once when he was 13. Yes, we will talk about Emma and Amy, and Sam's ruthlessness and low-key vengeance taken out on Dean in this episode. Fun times ahead. But there are other issues between Sam and Dean that I intend to explore, and the way Sam tries to minimize or dismiss all of Dean's observations and concerns in this episode for no reason other than vibes. Plus, we have more adventures of Bobby's flask, and the notion after the fact that Bobby was right there while Dean was knocking up the Amazon lady, probably plugging his ears and squeezing his eyes shut and wishing for oblivion. Like, this is the moron I risked the eternal hereafter to help out. Plus, we're going to complain about the handprint just a little bit because of who I am as a person. We have a few fun bonuses to this one, including the video promoting the People's Choice voting that year that was filmed during the filming of this episode, J2 Pantsless. It's worth your 30 seconds. And there's some other interviews linked on the Super Wiki page if you're interested, along with the set locations map and all the other usual bits and bobs. And my rewatch notes from July 2019 that cover all my thoughts and feelings on Sam and Dean's respective mindsets and emotional issues, which I will try to elaborate on in this podcast, but it's honestly a lot, and you should probably just take 10 minutes to read that post. There's also a bonus feature about directing Supernatural on this DVD disc that I haven't watched in years, but it is there if you own the DVDs and would care to watch it. So with that, let's get into the then segment. We open with Dick shooting Bobby, Dean's desperate reaction to that, Bobby's battle against his Reaper and his eventual death and his final choice, stay or go, that we didn't get an answer to. We're then reminded from 7-7 The Mentalists about Sam's anger with Dean over killing Amy and Dean's justification for it. Only took him 4 episodes to stop agonizing over it. And then Dean lamenting to Elliot Ness last week that he doesn't know why he's doing much of anything anymore. Followed by Frank's advice to him to quit. Dean's response that it isn't even an option, that he won't walk out on Sam. So Frank tells him to decide to be fine until the end of the week. Put on a smile, which we see in all its agonizing glory, and that miserable portrait of Dean's current mental state brings us to now. We see a man in an upscale apartment doing some work on his laptop, thinking that he heard something and looking a little bit unsettled about it. He tries to focus, but someone is sneaking in. He's flung across the room, then brutally and efficiently murdered by having his hands and feet hacked off and a strange sigil carved into his chest. And with that splat, we cut to the splat of the title card. Post-title card, Sam is driving their latest piece of shit car at night while Dean sleeps in the passenger seat. Dean wakes up, pulls out his flask for a drink, and Sam notices he's using Bobby's flask. He hadn't realized Dean kept it, and Dean makes the excuse that his flask sprung a leak, so he's just taking Bobby's, because it's convenient. Sam's already judging Dean for his choice of souvenir to carry around with him, and Dean insists he's honoring Bobby with it and processing his grief, and then grumps back that Sam is doing the same thing with their wild goose chase of a hunt. Sam's offended at that summary of four dead guys in 2 weeks that match their cold open victim, and asks if Dean even bothered to read the article that Sam gave him about the case. Dean replies that he was napping, so no, obviously he has not. But with Dick Roman leading them to lots of dead ends, they might as well stay busy, even if Dean's really kind of grumpy about it. At the morgue, they look at the body of the latest victim as the coroner asks if they always worked so late at night. Instead of being even remotely succinct and professional, Dean just leans into the lie he's telling this guy. He makes up this whole picture of falsehoods about the hours sucking, but the benefits being great. When the coroner shows even a tiny bit of interest, instead of redirecting back to the dead guy on the slab between them, Dean makes up something about a 10% copay on all drugs, and even doubles down on that again when the coroner assumes that it's only on generics, and Dean insists that no, it's on brand name drugs too. Like, what the fuck? Right? And that is clearly what Sam is thinking through this entire exchange as he repeatedly tries to interrupt and redirect them. I swear, this makes complete sense related to what we will see later in the episode, because this is literally the exact same flirtation play that Dean runs on the woman he literally has sex with later in this episode. If Sam hadn't been standing right there, maybe Dean could have avoided accidentally mating with the monster lady and just spent the night with the cute coroner dude instead. Honestly, he probably should have. Once Sam does successfully interrupt, Dean makes a little face like, oh right, you're still here and we're supposed to be doing an investigation. The 190-pound victim was tossed into a wall like a rag doll. Then his hands and feet were severed and the sigil was carved into his chest while he was still alive so the killer could watch him suffer. Like all the other victims, when Sam asks if they had any DNA from the killer, the coroner replies that yeah, they do, but they found no match for it. Not that they lacked a killer to match it to, but that the sample itself was apparently not even human. Which of course pings Sam and Dean as definitely monster. Definitely their kind of thing. Which Dean finally concedes when they leave the coroner's office. But when Sam suggests they go research that sigil and try to figure out what non-human thing could have left it, Dean nopes out of all of that. He's going to find a bar. He tries to frame it as doing research on their case and doesn't even let it bother him when Sam rolls his eyes about it. Dean needs a distraction. A night off from the rest of his problems to forget who he even is by pretending to be someone he's not, just for one night. And the bar he finds is honestly nothing like any bar we've ever seen Dean voluntarily go to. It's swanky, upscale. They have white chairs even. This is not his usual dive. The Cobalt Room, where lots of well-dressed and attractive people are mingling and trying to hook up. But Dean's in his fed suit and not his usual hunter chic, so he just rolls with it. It really makes me wonder what sort of lies he tells the rest of the people he's hooked up with over the series, because I will guarantee you that outside of Cassie, after a relationship spanning weeks, and Lisa, who he lived with for a year, he never, ever told the truth of himself or his life to anyone he ever had a one-night stand with. In the past, I have read serious criticism of Dean over how he lies to the woman at the bar, and honestly, I have zero problem with his lies, because the one thing neither of them lie about is that they are not interested in dating or a relationship. They are specifically looking for a one-night stand. literally anything else that Dean tells her after that is irrelevant. They've stated their intent. They find each other attractive and want to have sex with no strings attached. And then they act on it. The super icky part isn't any of that. Of Dean lying about being an investment banker or that he speaks a little Japanese. Or even that he's had a fortunate year. And I mean, he's had a pretty damn unfortunate year by all objective measurements. No, the super icky part is not the lies Dean tells, but the lies Lydia tells. Yes, she is looking for a one-night stand with a guy she intends to have murdered in a few days' time after he fathers her child for her. Dean was in this for one night of sex, not to spawn a monster baby and then die for it. And since Sam spends most of this episode being judgmental and dismissive toward Dean, I'm just not going to participate in more of the same. Lydia is making him feel good, and for the first time in a long time, his smile doesn't look agonized and fake. Right, so they move their conversation back to her house and do the do. Sex is therapy for Dean. Human contact and a way to get out of his own head for a little while. And while AC/DC plays, we see a montage of him getting hot and heavy with Lydia, intercut with a second montage of yet another man in another upscale apartment getting murdered, just like the cold open guy, and a series of crime scene photos getting snapped of his corpse. And the moment Dean's done and Lydia rolls away, he looks like he's already lost something again. Like that moment of reprieve, of human contact and intimacy, is over, and he already feels the loss of it. But this is the first time we really see Dean's shoulder since the end of season 5. Yes, we saw it in his dream sequence with Lisa in the beginning of season 6, and the handprint was gone then too. But that was a dream sequence and not concrete reality. So what happened to the handprint? Well, we know that back in that dream sequence in season 6, the makeup department forgot to apply it in the process of getting him ready to do a shirtless scene for the first time in a while. So because of that, they just chose to, oh well, I guess it's faded now, and never really offered any other explanation or reference back to it until way later in the season. And yes, handprints will become a thing like in season 11. It's a running theme through the season. But it's also a very big deal at the very end of the series. And I've always headcanoned that, yes, the handprint never was removed from him, but faded away like a normal scar does. And the underlying supernatural connection to Cass is still connected there. And I have a whole post that I wrote about it, about this episode and the handprint, in my tag for this episode and linked in the post for this podcast, for anyone who's as obsessed with the handprint as I am to enjoy. The next morning, Dean and Sam roll up to the crime scene, and Sam tells Dean that he looks awful. Dean says he feels like crap, had an awesome night, but he's getting too old for it. And yeah, he kinda is. But Dean is right back on the case, asking Sam about the symbol. He still hasn't discovered what it means, and thinks they need an expert. As they badge themselves into the crime scene, Dean dismisses that with the fact that their expert, meaning Bobby, is dead. At the crime scene, the friendly coroner from earlier introduces them to the detective on the case. Between the two of them, they explain all the details of how this case is similar to the previous ones. Decent-looking guys in their mid-30s, successful, no known enemies, and so on. All killed in the same way. The coroner calls the killer a monster, and the detective excuses herself, because as astute rewatchers, we know she's one of the Amazons herself and covering for her sisters. While Dean goes off with the coroner, and seriously, Dean should have just stuck to taking him out for drinks, Sam notices a neighbor loitering in the hall who'd been a friend of the victim and asks the guy if anyone would want to harm him. The neighbor says no. He was a nice guy. other than the little fling he'd had a few nights ago that his wife found out about. His wife had left, but there was no way she could have done all that to him, you know, throwing him across the room and chopping off his hands and feet like that. While Sam relays that info to Dean, he realizes he left Bobby's flask at Lydia's house the night before. Sam makes fun of Dean for not only knowing the woman's name, but that he's actually going to call her. I think this is wildly unfair of Sam. I'm pretty sure Dean knows the names of everyone he sleeps with, though the fact that he actually kept her number is kind of surprising. He casually admits that they always give him their number, which says just as much about Sam as it does about Dean, you know? The only woman we've ever seen give Sam her number was the hooker he paid while he was soulless. And yet for Dean, women want a repeat performance from him as a matter of routine. Best night of my life, Dean, as it were. He calls her, explains that he left the flask and that it has sentimental value, and he would like to get it back. Lydia's distracted and short with him, though, and Dean's kind of weirdly disappointed by this, not just because he's had a nice time with her, but because he's worrying that he might never get Bobby's flask back too, because it does have sentimental value from him. It's something that is truly important to him, who in the last year has lost almost everything else in his life, and she just tells him she's busy right then, but she'll call him if she finds it. Sam finds this entirely too amusing. Like, ha ha, Dean's getting dissed by a chick, ha ha ha. It's all very juvenile from Sam. But while Dean stands there looking sad, we cut back to Lydia, and the camera pans out until we see that she looks ready to pop pregnant. And she definitely hadn't looked like that last night. We then cut to later that night. Lydia surrounded by women as she gives birth in what could be some creepy candlelit dungeon, all businesslike. The woman in charge, in her business suit, states that they will call the baby Emma and then says, "Next," like they've got a production line of pregnant women to deal with. The next day at the Department of Anthropology, Sam finds an expert to talk to about that sigil. Professor Morrison says that he could probably tell them what it was if the FBI was offering suitable remuneration for his services. Since they can only offer him flimsy lies about a good word with the IRS, the professor eventually does relent, though, and tells them what he can see on it immediately. He can see that it's ancient, a regional script associated with worship, but it will require research. Sam and Dean get up to leave, saying they'll be back tomorrow then, and the professor laughs, implying he'd need months. When Dean cuts him off to remind him that they're hunting for a serial killer and don't have that kind of time, the professor counters with the fact that his housekeeper needs a green card and that he will do the research if they can make that happen for him. So, I mean, one lie on top of another, sure, we'll get her a green card. Worst case scenario, they can just forge one for her. As they leave, Dean is grumpy about this so-called expert. It's been a very long time since they've relied on an outside source like him, who didn't know the truth about the monsters they hunt, and think it's all just theoretical or mythology. And every time they've ever encountered an expert like that, who didn't know they were hunting a real thing, and asking for advice about reality, it's always gone a little bit pear-shaped. Dean's contemplating about how they're spinning their wheels, and Sam pulls him up with the fact that he wishes they could just call Bobby too, but they can't. Sam demanding that Dean try and stay in touch with reality instead of being mad about things they can't change, because Sam needs that anchor to reality, and Dean is that for him. Dean, however, just looks at his phone, irked that Lydia still hasn't called him back, which Sam again tries to make fun of him for. But Dean's actually getting annoyed with Sam now, because he really wants Bobby's flask back. If he can't have actual Bobby, the flask is serving as a sort of talisman for him at the moment, and Sam mocking him for that is just so damn annoying. Even Dean is fed up with him and tells Sam very seriously that Sam is enjoying this way more than he needs to. And of course, Sam doesn't take the hint and back off. So Dean goes back to Lydia's. He just leaves Sam there to walk home. When she opens the door, not only does she call him Don and then not even try to apologize when he corrects her, she looks shifty, looking around him up and down the road like she's waiting for someone else. She treats him dismissively, admitting she's gotten his messages and just didn't call him back when she found his flask. She tells him it's all beat up and she nearly just threw it out. Like, Mr. had a very fortunate year, could probably afford something better, doesn't understand the sentimentality of it. Dean again tries to act politely toward her when she lets him in to get the flask, commenting on why she's clearly been busy, babysitting. Instead of lying again, she tells him no, the baby is hers, which stuns Dean. There was no baby when he was there a day ago. Dean walks right over to the crib, makes more polite small talk until his phone rings and he walks away. It's Sam, grumpy that Dean is taking so long getting that flask back. Dean tells him he's engaging in social skills, and Sam scoffs. But we have seen Dean just trying to be nice. Sam kind of looks like a jerk in comparison. Sam has no further news from their expert, but wants Dean to come back because they're due at the crime lab. Dean's about to reply, but is distracted because he catches Lydia having a quiet conversation with the baby, and this toddler is speaking in full sentences like an adult, while Lydia is telling her not to talk, that they'll discuss it later. As Sam gets more and more hostile on the phone because Dean is ignoring him. When Dean hangs up on him, Sam leaves in a huff and goes to the coroner's office alone. The detective lady asks why the FBI is even interested in this case at all, but it's the coroner who chimes in with the fact that their victims are similar to a number of cold cases in other states. Sam clearly had no idea about those previous cases, but agrees that's exactly why they're there. The detective then dismisses him entirely, saying they're working on other cases too, as if the apparent rampaging serial killer in her town wasn't the most urgent thing for her to be working on. But once she leaves, Sam asks the coroner for copies of all those cold case files. While he gets them, Sam finds a card from the cobalt room among the evidence, and learns that's where all the victims had been out drinking a few days before they were murdered. And he knows Dean drank there too. The coroner even identifies it as a great place to hook up with someone. Meanwhile, Dean's been staking out Lydia's house when two women pull up, including the bossy lady doing the paperwork at Emma's birth. While they're in the house, Sam calls, upset that Dean never showed up at the coroner's office. Dean explains what he's doing, and Sam is kind of pissed with him, thinks Dean's obsessed with this woman. He just doesn't know when to stop joking around, and Dean is being deadly serious. Sam tells him about the pattern of killings. Similar victims all picked up at the same bar, now in Seattle, 2 years ago in Chicago, and 2 years before that in Miami. Sam's kicker is that a lot of the victims were picked up in the same bar Dean went to, and he grumpily says that Dean dodged a bullet since he's still alive and hasn't been murdered like the other guys. Dean again cuts Sam off, though, because his buffet of weird is continuing when the women, Lydia and Emma, the baby, now looking 5 or 6 years old, come outside. Emma leaves with the women, and Dean follows them to a building in some back alley before going back to pick up Sam. Later that night, Sam tries to dismiss everything Dean tells him. Dean insists everything he's saying is the truth, and Sam just repeatedly mocks him for all of it. He can't believe Dean would even notice if a woman he slept with had a kid or not. Doubts that the baby actually talked. Every argument Dean makes, Sam's got some snappy comeback because he thinks Dean is just obsessed with this woman and using it to try and get out of actually working the case, to the point where Dean is legitimately angry with Sam about his refusal to believe him. So it's no wonder that Dean's dismissive of Sam when he gets a call from their expert professor and Sam shushes him, like, rude on top of rude, Sam. Meanwhile, back with Emma and the other ladies, she's grown again, with a bunch of other girls her apparent age. They're all participating in an initiation ritual. All the other girls eat their bits of flesh without hesitation, but Emma has to be coaxed into it. But eventually, she complies. She has no other choice, right? And I have to wonder, why the hesitation when all the others didn't even flinch? Is it maybe because she has actually met her father? Saw him for who he was already instead of only meeting him when she arrives to kill him? Could be part of it, but it also could just be that they needed a reason to call out Emma so that we were aware it's the same girl growing so rapidly because buckleming in their weird obsession with monster babies going from baby to adult in a matter of days. I hate that trope. Anyway, moving on. We cut to the professor's classroom where he has the symbol on an overhead projector and is talking through his process of inquiry to Sam and Dean like this was entirely academic, like he's lecturing them. Eventually, he gets to the point that it's a variation of a symbol for the Greek goddess Harmonia, who, with the god Ares, produced the Amazons. Dean asks, like, Wonder Woman? And good on him for knowing that. But the professor insists the comics are silly perversions of the real thing. He explains Amazon culture, no use for men other than procreation, but after being impregnated, they would kill the fathers after cutting off their hands and feet, just like our victims. We cut to the police detective lady urgently whispering into the phone that she wasn't able to find any record of who those supposed FBI agents are. All she's been able to discover was that they're the same two guys from that cross-country murder spree a few months back, and describes them as thugs. And the bossy lady, Amazon, tells her to just add Sam to their hit list, since Dean's already scheduled to be murdered. Problem solved, right? Meanwhile, back at their motel, Dean is digging through boxes of books from Bobby's, looking for a specific Greek book, while Sam is getting fed up with him yet again. But at least he has his flask back. Sam has found a bunch of other stuff on Amazon lore that the professor didn't even mention, and Dean answers that not believing that they're still real is a handicap when they're trying to deal with them. The professor may give them academic information, but can't give them anything practical and probably is skipping over stuff that he believes is just mythology or fantasy, even if it might be relevant to Sam or Dean. And yeah, that is kind of a handicap. After a war, the Amazons made a deal with Harmonia to replenish their ranks and were turned into inhuman monsters. Dean asks if you can still kill them like humans, but Sam has no idea. When Dean asks what else he's learned, Sam hesitates and looks a little contrite as he confirms that they reproduce quickly, give birth within 36 hours of mating, and the babies grow to adulthood in days. And as Dean puts all of this together, Sam finally looks repentant for having made fun of Dean for this. As Dean gets to vent his righteous anger that this was exactly what he'd been telling Sam all along. Dean wasn't crazy or obsessed with this woman at all. He was just observing with his eyes. So while Dean is trying to process that the baby kid teen he saw was actually his monster child, Sam gets judgy on him for apparently not using protection with a random hookup, which, fair. But Dean is adamant that he did, and he's not at all happy about any of this. And really, I wouldn't be either. It's a complete violation. He did not consent to any of this. But right now, if all of that is true, then Dean knows he's put himself on the Amazon hit list, and that's an even bigger and more immediate concern. He takes yet another fortifying gulp from his flask. Back at Amazon headquarters, Bossy Lady stands in front of a fire pit and gives another initiation rite speech as all the girls are branded with the symbol of Harmonia and told that they must learn to endure pain and inflict it with courage. They've grown yet again and could be graduating high school now. Back at the hotel, Dean is still trying to find something useful in Bobby's disorganized files. Sam points out why they sought out attractive, successful men, because they wanted the best gene pool for their kids. But again, taunts Dean, wondering why they would have picked him. Like, you're not attractive or successful. And Dean tells him about the investment banker lie, to which Sam facepalms and shakes his head, turns his back on Dean, like he was disgusted with Dean. And see, this is why I refuse to get judgy with Dean about that. They were both in it for a one-night stand. Dean got that, and Lydia would have had that if she hadn't been a monster with ulterior motives, and everyone would have walked away happy. But I would argue that Dean is attractive. I mean, I don't think anybody denies that. And he might not be an investment banker, but he's probably the most successful hunter on the planet. He's not rich, but nobody is better than him at what he does, even if it doesn't happen to be investment banking. But while Dean's internalizing Sam's judgment, he turns back to the pile of Bobby's papers. The photos he'd just set down are gone, replaced with a handwritten parchment in Greek. Dean is both intrigued and alarmed that the papers rearrange themselves, and Sam goes for the EMF meter, which screeches with fluctuating readings all over the room, until Sam scoffs, dismissing it, because there's power lines right outside their open window where a little breeze is gently moving the curtains. Sam is insistent that the breeze moved the papers, enforcing his belief that nothing supernatural is happening, which, despite Dean's insistence that maybe it is, you'd think Sam would be just a wee smidge more open to it. Dean waves Bobby's flask, suggesting that maybe Bobby's ghost is actually there. Sam insists it can't be because they burned him, and when Dean presses him, wondering if maybe it is, Sam gets angry with him, insisting that it cannot be, because they want it to be, and they just never get nice things. But again, Sam's struggle this season is between what is real and what his hallucinations are trying to convince him is real. He just can't allow himself to believe it might be Bobby, just like he couldn't allow himself to believe what Dean was experiencing as strange all day until he had concrete, tangible proof that it was real. Just like his insistence that they validate their findings with the ding-dong professor. Dean tries to counter that the mysterious paper might be useful, makes rational observation after rational observation as Sam gets more and more distressed, coming up with excuses and counter-arguments that frankly sound less and less rational as he goes on. But eventually, he relents, grabs the paper, and storms off to take it to the professor to translate, just in case. Dean is like, really? Really? That guy again? But neither of them knows Greek, and the one guy they know who knows Greek is kind of a jerk, so they're stuck with that. But Sam leaves, demanding that Dean stay put with the door locked, because that's totally safe and not the exact state that the previous victims were murdered in, locked up safe in their homes. Dean at least has some alone time to reconsider all of his life choices, though. Sam storms into the professor's office on a mission, and over the man's protests, demands he translate the parchment. When he complains he's not being paid enough for this, Sam sweetens the deal, telling him they'll remove his wiretap. Meanwhile, back at the hotel, Dean's working on his laptop when there's a knock at the door. Of course, it's Emma, there to kill him. But he's not just any old father that needs killing. Emma's got a special job with him. Dean was ready with his gun at hand. He looks through the people and is surprised to see his full-grown daughter with a wild sort of horror, because they didn't know that detail yet. He was expecting Lydia to come kill him. Rather than a ravening beast ready to tear him apart, he's greeted by a soft-spoken woman who seems terrified. She pleads for Dean's help as the only person she can trust because she's in trouble. Dean asks why, probably because he just needed to hear it, to have it confirmed that it was real, and she answers that he's her father. Dean asks how she found him, and Emma says they've been watching him ever since her mother got pregnant, which is amazing to me, considering Dean was staked out in front of Lydia's house all day, and yet they did nothing to protect themselves or hide any of this from him. So apparently they weren't doing a very good job watching him. Either that, or they just didn't care. Dean asks if she's a prisoner, then how did she escape? She has an excuse at the ready, just like she has for why she left. She tells him she trusted them because it was all she knew. She didn't question what they asked her to do, even when it was terrible things, because she was tortured. She shows him the brand on her wrist as proof of that. She insists she doesn't want to be like them, even though we saw her willingly accept the brand. She doesn't want to inflict or endure pain. But even if Dean's not convinced yet, it does touch a nerve for him. He doesn't want to be like his father either, you know? But it's enough that he at least lets her in to hear her out. And I mean, if he's going to have to kill her, he doesn't want to do that in the hallway of a hotel. He asks what she wants him to do. She wants to get away from the Amazons. She says her mother told her that Dean was a good man, which Dean seriously doubts. So it's clear she's got some sort of script going here. Emma counters with the fact that he's a hunter. So maybe he would at least understand her and be able to protect her until she could get away. She then twists the knife just a little, saying she knows Dean doesn't want her. And Dean's kind of offended by that, stutters something out, and then tells her, "You get this isn't a normal situation, right?" And Emma replies that she wouldn't have any idea if it was or not, because she's only 3 days old. Her mother consigned her to that awful place to do awful things. And her father, Dean, and she doesn't finish that thought before telling him that he is her last chance to have anything normal ever. And oh, the Protect Sammy vibes she's generating here are powerful. Like, she's hitting on every aspect of Dean's core parental response to Sam. This whole, "I'm a freak and no one wants me, but all I want is to be normal and you're my only chance to get that," is Dean's entire central conflict with Sam. And Emma is just poking at that. Meanwhile, the professor is fascinated with Sam's paper as Sam looms over his desk, pressing him for answers. But the professor hasn't even bothered trying to read it yet. He's still examining the literal paper it's written on. Sam's about to get mad at him, but the professor asks where Sam even got such a fine example, and Sam just replies, "A crazy, drunk, old genius." And the professor laughs that they always have the good stuff. But I do appreciate that the frustration Sam is experiencing here trying to get answers from the professor is nearly identical to the frustration Dean has been experiencing with Sam for most of the episode. How's it feel, Sam? Kind of crappy, right? The information that the professor does eventually learn from the parchment is that it's not the mothers who do the killing of the fathers, but their child. This is shocking news to Sam, just as we cut back to Dean, now alone in the hotel room with his very own Amazon child murderer. Dean tells Emma that she looks exhausted, and she adds, "and starving." She definitely inherited Dean's sarcasm as she complains that it's been a tough sweet 16. She asks if Dean believes her. He doesn't answer immediately, and then she asks if he will help her. He crosses his arms and tells her that if she really wants it, and then we cut. We don't hear his answer. Like, he's willing to hear her out. Like, if she wants his help, he's going to make sure that she really wants his help. As Sam rushes out of the professor's office, trying desperately to call Dean to warn him, the Amazon detective lady bumps into him and asks what he's doing there. And honestly, he should have been like, what the hell are you doing here at this college at middle of the night? Sam tries to ask if they can talk in the morning, but she grabs his arm as he tries to pass her, and it clearly hurts him. He sees her brand mark and knows that she is an Amazon, and she knows exactly who he is. She flashes her creepy Amazon eyes and flings him down some stairs and into a door as a knife drops out of her sleeve and she goes to close in on Sam, prepared to kill him in the ritual fashion. But Sam pulls a gun and shoots her dead first. And yes, apparently regular bullets do kill Amazons as well as they kill people. Nice that he has proof of concept and knows what an Amazon looks like right before they go in for the kill, because Emma is going to flash him that look in a minute here. In the fight, Sam's phone was shattered, and now he has no way to call and warn Dean other than driving like hell. Dean asks what will happen when the others find her missing, and Emma says they may have already discovered that, but they will hunt her down. She's pressuring him to hurry, to take her away to safety. And Dean is dragging his heels. He wants concrete answers yet. He wants certainty. And just the fact that Emma is pressuring him to stop thinking about it and just act, that feels like the danger signal, you know? That's the warning sign. And Dean is not okay with that. He opens the fridge, turning his back on her, offers her the sliced cheese or leftover burrito they have in there. But while his back is turned to her, Emma says it doesn't make a difference, and then a knife drops from her sleeve, just like the detective lady did. Dean whips around with his gun pointed at her and says, "You asked if I believed you," and, you know, kind of clearly he did not believe her. Sam's driving like hell still, but we cut back to Emma, cool, calm, and collected as she tells Dean that she was told he would be a challenge. Which is a very different story than what she'd been telling Dean about how she'd tried to escape. They let her go. Informed him that it's going to be hard to kill this guy. Dean replies that she almost caught him off guard because he wasn't expecting her. He was expecting Lydia. We cut back to Sam running a red light. And then back to Emma, indignant that Dean would think that because it's not her mother's place to kill him. That's her job. It's what she is. Dean still tries to reason with her. She doesn't have to kill him. She could choose something else. But she taunts him that if he was going to kill her, he could have done it 30 seconds ago. Like, why is he hesitating when he knows she will do what she was born to do? Sam pulls up outside the building as Emma taunts Dean some more. That it's weirdly hard to kill her because she understands. It's hard for her to kill her own father, too. Dean tells her to knock it off, but she's mad. She wouldn't be there at all if it weren't for him, and now one of them has to kill the other. And ain't that Chuck's grand plan story time for ya? Someone has to kill the other, and it's gotta be painful and filled with regret. And throw in a magical baby that Dean struggles to kill when push comes to shove, and yet still doesn't entirely trust in the end. I see you there, Chuck, and it really pisses me off. Sam is now listening at the door, though, and he has none of the weird baggage with Emma that Dean does. He sneaks quietly into the room while Dean continues to plead with her that she hasn't killed anyone yet. She can still walk away. She tells him that she can't. She doesn't have a choice. And we all hate that phrase. And that's all Sam needed to hear before he's busting into the room with his gun drawn. She turns on Sam and flashes her creepy Amazon eyes at him, warrior mode or whatever, and then turns back to Dean, pleading with him to protect her. Like, it's one final infliction of pain on Dean, just because she can. Dean starts to lower his gun, looking at Sam, horrified by the rage on his brother's face. But Emma turns back to Sam, just standing there, doing nothing but looking at him. He hesitates for just a moment before shooting her dead. And the look on Dean's face kinda says it all. Like, what the fuck, man? Like, Dean was talking to her. He was fully capable of killing her if she did not relent and show true contrition. Yes, I truly believe that Dean would have killed her. But Sam does not. Later that night, Sam and Dean go back to Amazon headquarters to clear the place out, but it's already been deserted, abandoned for whatever town they've chosen to run to next. Guess we'll find out in 2 years. Or not, since they're never ever mentioned again for the rest of the series. Maybe the British Men of Letters wiped them out. Who knows? Once again, it's Sam driving as they leave town. Sam really desperately wants to be in control during this episode, yes? He's staring at the road intently, like it insulted him. And the engine noise is loud, like he's got it floored. And he doesn't look happy at all. Dean tells him that he's not happy either. He wanted to torch the rest of the Amazons too, but now they know how to find them. And they'll be ready when they surface again, if Sam and Dean aren't dead yet themselves. And I mean, for a hunter, sometimes that's the best you can hope for. We're armed with all the information now. We'll recognize it when we see it, and we can just swoop in and solve the whole problem. Sam doesn't reply, and Dean gets grumpy with him, like, fine, just sit there and be pissed. And then Sam reveals exactly what he's pissed about. He thinks Dean choked, like he did with Amy. Sam had convinced himself that Dean was about to let Emma go. When Dean says he was going to kill Emma, Sam is outraged and insistent that he knows Dean wasn't. Sam's justification to Dean is that she was not his kid, not really. And it sounds like Sam is trying to convince himself of that, because otherwise, he just murdered his brother's child, which is not at all the same as what Dean did to Amy. Sam needs to reconcile this, but Dean is sticking to the facts, to the truth. Yes, Emma really was his. She just also happened to be a crazy man-killing monster. Sam has some entirely undeserved and far too harsh judgment for Dean here, and I have written extensively about this before in that link post I mentioned at the top of this podcast, because it's Sam's distortion of the truth and not the actual truth that he's basing all this anger on. He says Bobby was right about Dean, that his head's not in the game since Cass died, but it's worse now with Bobby's death, that Dean is apparently failing to accept is real, like Sam has. And, hoo boy, I've talked long enough and, again, have tidily already typed out a whole entire post about just this bit here. But Dean retorts with the fact that Sam is also not handling Bobby's death well. It just looks different on Sam because Sam's bigger. And I kind of think Dean hesitated on that ridiculous insult because the truth was just way too harsh. And Dean is not about to throw Sam's hallucinations and grip on reality in general out the window in order to win an argument, you know? Because he's not a total asshole, even if Sam might deserve a slightly harder reprimand for how he's been treating Dean all episode. Nobody ever deserves to have their mental illness used against them like that. But at least it helps defuse Sam's anger with complete bafflement. And under all that anger, we finally uncover the root of Sam's issues. He practically pleads with Dean. He really doesn't care how Dean deals with his grief, no matter how much he may have teased him about his coping mechanisms during the episode, taunting about being obsessed with Lydia, about going to the bar, and even believing Bobby's ghost might be trying to help them. All Sam really cares is that Dean doesn't get himself killed, because he came close that night and it terrified Sam. Because what on earth would Sam do if he lost Dean? Well, for starters, he'd know how Dean feels right now already, because at least a little bit of Sam's reaction to Emma really does come off like oldest child hating the new baby, you know? But she did strangely encapsulate Dean's relationship with his own father, being sent on impossible missions when he was far too young, forced to grow up too fast, to handle things he could never be expected to succeed at. I mean, the Amazons didn't even do as good as John did, bursting in at the last moment to save her, you know? And I say this as, in the background, I have season 1, episode 18, Something Wicked playing in the background, where Dean nearly gets killed, taking care of like 5-year-old Sam, and John comes barging through the door, fails to kill the Striga, and at least saves Dean's life, even if he never looks at Dean the same again and kind of judges Dean hard for his failure to kill the monster when he's like 9 years old. So, I mean, the Amazons couldn't even do that level of craptastically bad parenting. No, they were in a whole new abyss of bad parenting. Then again, Sam had already killed their likely cleanup hitter while the rest of them had fled town. I think the detective lady was supposed to be there to back Emma up, but, you know, she failed to kill Sam first, so. Would Dean have been able to do it, though, to pull the trigger on Emma? And yeah, I think he would have. I do not think he was lying to Sam about that or wrongly trying to convince himself that of course he would. But through Sam's perception, Dean needed the assist, and honestly, I'm weirdly relieved for Dean that he didn't have to kill his own daughter. Would Emma have actually spared Dean, taken him up on the offer to run off and be free of her destiny? I think the entire point of her character is that she never would have. It's not something that we can ever know, because she is dead and can't make choices anymore, but the whole point of her was that she is what she was born to be, and she had no other choice. Worst phrase on the show, honestly. But in order to be what she was born to be, she needed to do this thing. She really didn't have a choice. Otherwise, what's even the point of her existence, in her mind, and in the mind of all the Amazons? So Emma was an object lesson for Dean. Just another bit of torture in a season intent on flogging him with the consequences of his own rebellion from the grand plan. His big destiny he keeps trying to run away from, but that keeps pushing him back into these wrenching, devastating situations. Chuck's an evil bastard, and that's my main takeaway here. But seriously, go read my old reaction post to this episode that I linked, written a full year before the end of the series aired. And on that note, we will have some fun next week. Strangely, one of my comfort episodes of the entire series, right in the middle of all this trauma. Maybe because for once, we're mostly flogging Sam instead of Dean. It's kind of a relief, honestly. Tune in next week for season 7, episode 14, Plucky Pennywhistle's Magical Menagerie, where we'll have Sam beaten to a pulp by clowns. Good times! Until then, you can find me on Tumblr at MittensMorgul or at SPNGeorge. You can find me on Blue Sky and Discord as MittensMorgul, or you can email me at MittensMorgul@gmail.com. And I look forward to talking to everybody again real soon. And yeah, I mentioned that I've got Something Wicked on in the background. Oh, Sam's in his purple dog shirt. I just have the TNT loop muted while I was recording the end bit here. Kind of a good comparison there. But that reminds me that for years, the TNT loop has always shown the original season 1 music. You know, you get Inagata DeVita and Skin, and you get Blue Oyster Cult playing all through Hell House, and Don't Fear the Reaper in Faith. And it's like, what the hell happened? they're showing the Netflix music on the TNT loop now. And it absolutely sucks. And I'm really, really glad I own the DVDs. So just a heads up. This is the first time I've been through the TNT loop where I've noticed that they swapped the music. And sometimes I'm not really paying attention, especially in early seasons that I've seen like 50 times. That is not an exaggeration. That's probably an underestimation. But I'm just horrified, you know. No more good music in season one. And I lament that there's now no place airing or streaming where you can watch the original version. And the only place you can is on the Blu-ray or on the DVD. So I do highly recommend, if you have the capability, to get at least season one on Blu-ray and DVD, and you've never seen it with the real music, take this as a good opportunity to spend a few hours and go do that, because it's a totally different viewing experience. I forgot how bad the Netflix music really is. So that's my rant and lament for today. Have a good one, everyone.